ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 5th of February. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Japan has issued fresh safety warnings to tourists after the death of three young Australians on their ski fields. Authorities now warn conditions in this record-breaking snow season look set to worsen. Our North America correspondent, Alison Horn, has more.
This is a quick snow report from Seki Onsen in Niigata, Japan.
Australian Matt Guy creates social media content about his life and work in Japan's snowfields. He's been in the region for about 10 years and operates ski tours with foreigners, a job that comes with high risk.
Conditions do change on the same day. It doesn't matter how much you're prepared with all the best equipment and technology, nature's pretty powerful. And anything can happen.
Matt Guy has seen his share of accidents working as a safety ski patroller. And his advice for Australians travelling to Japan is be prepared.
Just see where you are and gather the information that this place is pretty powerful. There's signage there to talk about how much snow there is, how people have been dealing with that for the last hundreds of years. And then on top of that, I think it makes a lot of sense to go out with guides, to go with people who know their way around.
Australians are the largest group of visitors to Japan's snowfields each year, and the industry has been shocked by the tragic deaths of three young Australians in the last few weeks. 17-year-old Rylan Prabhati in January, and earlier this week, 27-year-old Melbourne man Michael Hurst and 22-year-old Queensland woman Brooke Day. The head of Japan's National Ski Safety Measures Council, Makoto Takayanagi, says accidents involving foreigners seem to be on the rise.
Within Hokkaido alone, there were 58 ski-related accidents between the 1st of November and the 2nd of February. Of these, 48 involved foreign nationals. The current situation is that foreigners make up a significant proportion.
Japanese authorities have also just issued extra safety warnings for tourists and locals as a record-breaking snow season is set to worsen. At least 35 people have been killed so far in recent weeks from incidents related to the extreme snowfall. In some areas, more than 1.5 metres has been dumped in one day. Australian Ben Kerr is on the tourism board of the popular ski area Niseko and says Japan's snowfields are safe.
Obviously, with these kind of tragedies, the tourist boards work very hard to put out information to all of the guests, just telling to people to really be careful, to make sure they're skiing together with their friends, they know where they are and that they're carrying the right items if they're going back country.
The families of the three Australians who died described them as snow lovers. The Department of Foreign Affairs is offering consular assistance. This is Alison Horn reporting for AM.
The Trump administration says it will pull hundreds of federal immigration agents out of the state of Minnesota. It comes after outrage over the shooting deaths of two Americans who were protesting against deportation raids in the city. This move is the latest de-escalation in the White House's contentious immigration operation. Our reporter, Emily Grimenz, is in Washington.
Well, 700 federal agents are out of Minnesota as of today. This announcement is effective immediately. Tom Homan, who is Donald Trump's border czar, has been promising more targeted operations there in Minneapolis. He was sent in after federal agents shot and killed two people, Renee Good and Alex Preddy, last month. Now, both of these people were US citizens who were protesting the overwhelming scale and the aggressive tactics of this operation, Operation Metro Serve. So Tom Homan was sent in to right the ship in some ways. He promised better cooperation with state and local authorities, and he says that that's going so well that now they can pull these 700 agents out. Now, it's important to point out, while this is something of a big de-escalation, 2,000 federal officers will remain in Minnesota, which far outnumbers the Minneapolis police force. Tom Homan has been heralding that better cooperation with local authorities, but he has also appeared to suggest that some of the protest activity that continues in Minneapolis is the reason that a larger drawdown isn't happening yet.
My goal with the support of President Trump is to achieve a complete drawdown and end this surge as soon as we can. But that is largely contingent upon the end of the illegal and threatening activities against ICE and its federal partners that we're seeing in the community.
That's the White House's so-called border czar, Tom Homan. Emily, how do you think this news will be received in Minneapolis?
Well, this is a community, Isabella, that has really been grappling with such a large operation happening in their city. As I said, there's been widespread protests. A lot of members of the community are very resistant to this massive operation in their city. Communities have been really impacted, especially immigrant communities. Many people are afraid of being stopped or detained in this operation, whether they entered America illegally or not. The Minneapolis mayor, who is among the local officials who have been really in opposition to the presence of armed federal agents on the streets of Minneapolis, he called this a step in the right direction, but said that he wanted to see this go further. He wants a full de-escalation. That's largely echoed by the state governor, Tim Walz. He says the operation is not making Minneapolis safer. He wants a faster and a larger drawdown. And Tim Walz also says that he wants a state-led investigation into the killings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty. So there's still some work to be done to get the state and the local officials really on the same page as the Trump administration.
Emily Grimenz in Washington. Tech giants are failing to keep our kids safe online. That's the finding of the latest report from Australia's eSafety Commissioner. It found big companies have the tools and resources to stop child abuse online, but often don't. Political reporter Sarah Tomevska has more.
For Wodonga mum Renelda Vanderberg, keeping her 8-year-old daughter offline for as long as possible is a top priority.
One of the main concerns that I have about it is not necessarily her on it, but the things that can happen to her when she's on it.
According to the eSafety Commissioner's second transparency report, which summarises responses from 8 tech giants, companies like Apple, Google, Meta and Microsoft are failing to find and tackle what Commissioner Julie Inman-Grant describes as the worst of the worst online content.
When we're talking about child sexual exploitation, including sexual extortion, these are high-risk, high-impact issues that have devastating consequences. You know, this has resulted in suicides.
Her latest report has found companies do have technology to prevent such crimes, but selectively use it. For example, Meta uses tools on Facebook and Instagram Live to detect live stream child abuse, but not on its Messenger app, while Apple FaceTime, Snapchat, WhatsApp, and Microsoft Teams don't use proactive detection tools on any of their services.
If you can do it on one service, you can do it on another. These companies are creating and they're selling advanced AI systems, but they're not eating their own dog food and using really basic AI technologies to detect languages like, do you want to have a sexy chat? That kind of beggars belief.
And the reason?
These are business and revenue and growth decisions.
There were some positives since the first report last August. Tech companies are getting better at detecting child sex abuse material that's been flagged by police, sharing information and responding faster to notifications of abuse. But Julian Mingrant says it's still not good enough.
Criminals who want to use video conferencing technologies to live stream child sexual abuse will just move to the next video conferencing platform that doesn't have those protections. And this is why we kind of need to lift the safety standards across the industry.
For Renelda Vanderberg, it's another reason to keep her daughter offline.
It comes down to protecting your child's life. And that is how serious it can be.
What would you say to tech giants who may not be applying all of the tools at their disposal?
I would say probably number one, it's only a matter of time before it is your child that is exposed to these things. And is that really what you want?
The ABC has contacted Digi, the peak body representing tech companies, for comment.
That report from Sarah Tomevska. New research shows a trend towards harsher bail laws in Australia is putting more Indigenous Australians behind bars. These kinds of reforms have been introduced in some states and territories to try and combat street and youth crime. The study suggests it's contributed to an increase in the Indigenous prison population at a faster rate than the non-Indigenous prison population. Bridget Fitzgerald with this report.
Despite years of national targets aimed at reducing the overrepresentation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in prisons, incarceration rates are getting worse. Narita Waite is the acting co-chair of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services.
We feel like often enough we're just beating our heads up against a brick wall because for generations we've been saying, stop putting billions upon billions of dollars in prisons and start putting them in the support services.
A study by the Australian Institute of Criminology out today has found recent reforms across Australia are making it harder for people to get bail, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are disproportionately represented. Between 2013 and 2024, the Indigenous adult imprisonment rate increased 46%, compared with a 10% increase in the non-Indigenous rate.
Whenever there is a high profile or public incident of violence or other offending, suddenly there's this push that the bail laws are the things that have failed. It's never the decision maker. It's never the system. It's always the law that has failed. And I think that's why we're seeing this continual erosion of the common law doctrine around presumption of innocence.
Between 2019 and 2025, harsher bail amendments were introduced in every state and territory except Tasmania. Dr. Samantha Bricknell is from the Australian Institute of Criminology and one of the study authors.
There's obviously been a lot of commentary about increasing crime rates, particularly around youth crime and the sorts of crimes that the young people are alleged to have committed, and so there have been a lot of amendments relating to youth offenders, again with the expansion of show cause offences, so the sorts of offences that they have to sort of demonstrate why they should be given bail if they have committed or allegedly committed that offence.
Dr. Bricknell says there's been a stark increase in the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people held on remand.
If you look back at, say, 2018-2019, around a third of Indigenous prisoners were on remand. That's gone up to 44-45% in that short time frame up to 2025.
Dr. Bricknell says the study didn't look at whether more punitive bail laws led to a reduction in crime, but she says there's strong evidence that people who have been incarcerated are more likely to re-offend. Narita Waite says community support in mental health, education, drug and alcohol services and housing need to be prioritised to keep Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people out of the justice system in the first place.
Making sure that we understand that community safety is achieved by strengthening communities, not locking them away.
The federal government has previously acknowledged the overrepresentation of First Nations people in prisons is unacceptable and says it continues to invest in justice reinvestment programs.
That report from Bridget Fitzgerald. Young, vulnerable people are missing out on much-needed community housing, sometimes due to invisible policy hurdles. A youth delegation is travelling to Canberra to raise awareness for these barriers and urge the government to use the upcoming budget to fix it, as Oliver Gordon reports.
18-year-old Ella has been in and out of homelessness since the age of 13.
Didn't know that I was homeless back then. I was just surviving.
She was vulnerable and says people tried to take advantage of that.
I was offered a place to live by an older man in the CBD, a nice apartment, and he told me confidently he had a fetish for young Indigenous girls.
Luckily, Ella found a room in a safe place, just in time.
I was very much going to take it, and I think that I knew how risky and awful it was, but I also just wanted a home so much more. So I was willing to accept those consequences.
The Home Time campaign is a coalition of researchers, community services and peak bodies trying to reduce youth homelessness. This week, the group has sent Ella to Canberra to share her story with decision makers.
I saw a lot of them cry and be very impacted by the realities that we all face on the streets.
It's also released a new report, which makes the economic case for funding youth homelessness programs that provide wraparound support.
We've seen educational
engagement rise from 28% to as high as 77%. This is not one program, but all youth housing programs across the country.
The report suggests that by investing in programs like this, governments could save money on health, justice and unemployment costs. The report also highlights the youth housing penalty. Shauna Moore again.
Currently, housing providers are at a significant financial disadvantage when they're considering any young person for tenancies in their housing due to their lower rental income through the social security system, which means the amount of rent that can be collected from a young person's income is half of what can be collected from an older person. It doesn't even cover the basic operational costs of the tenancy.
She says it's time for the federal government to step in to provide a youth housing supplement, a payment to either a young person or community housing provider to bridge that gap. And Shauna Moore has been in Canberra this week, meeting with ministers.
The housing minister, along with many other ministers and senators and MPs, have definitely acknowledged the problem, understand the problem. They've been engaged with us in discussing these possible solutions, but there's been no commitment that's been made.
AM asked the Housing Minister and Social Services Minister if they'd consider including such a subsidy in the next federal budget. A government spokesperson said it would keep working with the community housing sector on how to better help young people access housing, but wouldn't preempt the budget process.
Oliver Gordon reporting. Life after a cancer battle can bring many physical and psychological and social challenges. Many survivors feel this tough journey after treatment is ignored. Now, a world-first research centre for cancer survivorship in Sydney is looking to change that. Isabel Masali reports.
A few months ago, Phoebe Phillips lost her 52-year-old husband to advanced liver cancer.
Josh had childhood cancer, and in fact, the treatments that saved his life set up a cascade of events which caused the liver cancer later in life. And so I was able to see as a carer what the gaps in the system are.
Now she hopes those gaps will be closed for others. She's a survivor herself, a professor in cancer research at the University of New South Wales, and is on the board of the state's Cancer Council. Together, they're launching a $40 million initiative focused on improving outcomes for survivors.
My main hope for the centre really is demonstrated by my husband's last words, which were live and breathe. When you're going through cancer, right from the point of diagnosis all the way to your last breath, you want quality of life. I think we inadvertently kill the spirit while we're trying to kill the cancer.
Professor Bogda Kuzwara is the director of the new Australian Research Centre for Cancer Survivorship.
Being cancer-free is not exactly the same as being free of cancer. The treatment itself and the diagnosis of cancer and the experience of cancer diagnosis leave permanent consequences. Some of them are minor, some of them are major.
That includes physical changes like pain, fatigue, and psychological challenges such as the fear of cancer returning, along with financial issues and social isolation. Professor Kuzwara says these areas will be researched to make life after cancer less challenging than it is today.
And if you want to deliver bold, impactful solutions, you need to start with a bold idea, an ambition, and an investment to match. And I think that this centre certainly positions itself exactly that way.
Professor Sarah Hosking from Cancer Council New South Wales explains more than 1.6 million Australians are living with or beyond cancer, and survival rates have seen enormous improvement in recent decades.
At the same time, we're seeing an increasing number of cancer diagnoses, particularly with ageing population and the growing size of the population. More and more people surviving cancer, which is what we want, and more people living beyond their diagnosis and beyond their treatment. And because of that, it's really time to really focus on doing more research in cancer survivorship and looking at how we can actually improve our systems and process in health to make sure that we give the very best care that we can to people after diagnosis.
Professor Sarah Hosking from Cancer Council New South Wales, ending that report by Isabel Masali. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Gold, who doesn't like it? Well, right now it's really having a moment. its price rising about 80% over the past year in the United States, thanks to, I'm sorry to say, Donald Trump. Today, business correspondent David Taylor on gold and why people have been queuing to buy it. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.